I'm Heather Bale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Anthony Curry, Director of Public Policy for Opportunity 180. We've got a primary election coming up, and the organization has released a voter guide to help you make important decisions. Anthony, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
So what exactly is Opportunity 180?
Opportunity 180 is a local nonprofit with a focus on education. We don't do any direct-to-student services, but we try to influence the ecosystem around education to produce higher quality and push everything in the right direction. Our North Star at Opportunity 180 is that we want every student to be able to graduate from high school, college, or career ready, prepared to live the life that they dream.
And what does the name mean?
So Opportunity 180, the idea behind it is we want to turn things around. And when you turn something around and you want to be going the opposite direction, that's a 180-degree turn. So there's opportunities in education, and we want to turn things around completely. So complete 180.
Nice. Okay. So tell us about your recently released 2024 primary election voter guide.
Yes. So the voter guide, the idea behind it is that the races for school board and state board are often overlooked. I don't think it's an uncommon experience for a voter to walk into the voting booth and see the names for these races and not know a whole lot about those people. And so the idea is that we wanted to be able to get as much information to voters as possible so that they can make decisions on the people who are going to represent them in these seats and try to be able to pick the candidates that best represent their interests and values.
Okay, so this primary is education focused, but what position specifically are we voting on this time?
That's a great question. So we have races for Clark County School Board of Trustees. We have races for the State Board of Education. And then for the first time in Opportunity 180, we're also covering the races in Northern Nevada and Washoe County. So for the Washoe County Board of Trustees.
Okay. Now, you've asked some questions to the various candidates on various issues. What were the sorts of questions that you asked them?
That's a great question as well. Questions that were in the voter guide questionnaire included questions about the candidates' plans for improving student outcomes, how they would eliminate barriers to students attaining educational excellence, and how they would approach assessing the performance of superintendents. Since Washoe County, they just picked a new superintendent, and in Clark County, they're still searching for a superintendent. Lars Mitchell is the interim superintendent for Clark County School District.
Okay, so why are these specific issues important to focus on?
I think that the idea behind some of the questions that we asked were we want to make sure that candidates who are going into these positions are basing their approach and their thoughts for improving education on the data that we have. I think that we talk a lot in the community about where education stands, but a lot of that is anecdotal. And so we want candidates who are focusing and thinking about how to approach these things from a data-based mindset.
Okay. So I know that the organization doesn't endorse specific candidates, but what are some of the standout results or trends that you noticed among the answers?
Yeah. So like you point out, we don't endorse. The guide is done in a very nonpartisan way. We submit the questions to the candidates. They submit their responses and the responses are published as is. Participation is completely voluntary. I think that one of the things that we noticed in some of the responses that we received from all the candidates who participated is that they are really recognizing that there is, you know, a leadership challenge within Clark County School District specifically. We saw similar answers about what's going on in Washoe County School District. And then we also noticed that a lot of the candidates who responded had pretty strong ideas about what the cause of some of the lagging student performance is, whether they think that that is based on the curriculum or whether they think that's based on what the schools and school districts are prioritizing in terms of how kids are engaged in the classroom.
Okay. Now, you did mention it was voluntary, and I noticed that some of the candidates didn't answer. Did they give a reason for not answering, or they just didn't respond?
So in most of the cases, well, in all of the cases, actually, the candidates didn't respond. One of the things that we found, since this is our first time doing a primary election voter guide, we've done the voter guide and election cycles going back to 2020, but we normally did it in the general election. One of the things we found with doing the primary voter guide is that there were a lot more candidates, one, And two, their information for contacting them wasn't always available. So what we did was we did everything reasonable that we could think of to try to find contact information for these candidates, either by looking at the information, if it was publicly available, provided to the county registrar or the secretary of state. And then we did a social media effort to like get contact information for people that we didn't have their information at that point. And then we sent emails to all of them requesting their participation. And some people, a number of them, obviously, they responded and their information is in the voter guide. And most of the others, we just didn't get a response back.
Okay. Now, for the Board of Education candidates, it's divided up into numbered districts, District 1, District 2, District 3, District 4. And then for CCSD, even though it's Clark County School District, we have districts within the district, and those ones are divided up by letters, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. But how do we know what district we're in so we know which candidates to study?
Heather, you must be a professional at this. That's another excellent question. I hope my joke came off pretty well there. So the best way to find out which district you're in is to actually go to ccsd.net/trustees. And when you go there, you'll be able to see maps for the different areas of town that have their board seats open for this election cycle. So you can pull that up and just see where your house is located within there. For the State Board of Education and for Washoe County, if you go to their websites, they actually have a tool where you can enter in your address and it'll show you who represents you.
Okay. So the CCSD districts are by home address and not by school address?
That's correct.
Okay. Because I live in one district, but my son's high school, because the division's right at that street, he's in another district, but that's okay. So I vote in my district.
Right. So your voting is actually based off of your home address. So whoever represents the area where your home is, just because that's where your voting address is based.
Okay, perfect. Now, when exactly does the primary election happen?
So the primary election is on June 11th, and then early voting actually started on May 25th.
And we have mail-in ballots that they're sending out, and basically we can vote by mailing in the ballot, we can drop it off at an early voting center, we can vote in person early, or we can vote on election day, June 11th.
That's correct.
Okay, plenty of options. So where can listeners go if they want to find out more information, first of all, about Opportunity 180 and what you guys do, or access the 2024 primary election voter guide and look at some of the answers that the candidates have provided?
So to learn more about Opportunity 180 or to access our primary election voter guide, you can go to our website, which is opportunity180.org. On the front page, you'll find a link to the voter guide in the spotlight section. And that'll take you to the web version of our voter guide, which is available in English, Spanish, and Tagalog. And then if you're a person who likes to have more of a like documented format of that, might not on the web, we have PDF versions available as well that are also available in English, Spanish, and Tagalog.
Nice. Okay. So once again, opportunity180.org is the website to go to. That's the number 180. So opportunity180.org. You can find out more about what the organization does. And if you're interested in the upcoming primary election, you can check out the 2024 primary election voter guide, which is right there on the website, opportunity180.org. They've listed out the various candidates for CCSD, Washoe County, and the Board of Education. So all of it's right there. You can see your candidates. If you're not sure what district you're in for either CCSD or the Board of Education, there's resources where you can find out what they are, ccsd.net, or follow the link through to the Board of Education trustees. And once again, all of that is at opportunity180.org. And we've been speaking today with Anthony Curry. He's the Director of Public Policy for Opportunity 180. And Anthony, I really appreciate you putting together this guide, because I've already started looking through and making some decisions based on what I saw. As you mentioned, you know, a lot of us don't know who these people are. So it's really helpful to be able to see them and be able to read the answers in their own words and find out what they stand for and what's important to them so that we can make decisions based on what's important to us. So I really appreciate your time here today. Thank you so much.
Heather, thank you so much for having me. And I'm really glad that the voter guide is proving valuable to you. It's one of the reasons we put it together, and it's the only one of its kind in the state. So really appreciate your time today as well.
Teachers are diverse, skilled leaders, innovating to prepare students for our fast-changing world. Teaching shapes lives. Are you ready? Explore teaching at teach.org, supported by the U.S. Department of Education and 1 million teachers of color.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Edward Cousineau, Executive Director of the Nevada State Board of Medical Examiners. Edward, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the Nevada State Board of Medical Examiners?
Well, the Nevada State Board of Medical Examiners is a statutory creation. I would point out initially that we are the oldest regulatory board in the state. It was stood up in 1899, so we're actually celebrating 125th anniversary this year. We are basically an entity that handles licensure and discipline on several types of medical professionals, the most significant being our medical doctors, which we have about 11,000 licensees. We also license physician assistants, and we have about 1,200 physician assistant licensees currently. Practitioners of respiratory care, about 2,000 there, and then perfusionists, which we have less than 100. And then just this last session, the legislature gave us another profession to regulate, and that is anesthesiologist assistants. We only have, I believe, a grand total of 5 now because that just became the law back in January, but I'm sure we'll start seeing those numbers go up over time. And then the board itself is actually comprised of 11 board members who are appointed by the governor. 6 of them are doctor members, 3 non-physician public members. And then we also, as of this last session, have 2 new members, a physician assistant and a respiratory therapist. They can serve up to 2 consecutive 4-year terms. And so, again, right now, that's our composition. We have basically been regulating since the turn of the last century, and I certainly will get into details as more what we do, but that's kind of, I guess, the makeup of the board itself.
Okay. So what types of services does the Nevada State Board of Medical Examiners provide for these licensees?
Well, licensees specifically, I mean, we have a website that we encourage both our licensees and our consumers to access. The licensees themselves, well, first off, obviously, if you're coming to Nevada, you're going to need to determine, you know, what are the legal requirements to be licensed in the state. They do vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So we have that information, of course, allows the new applicants or even current applicants who've already established will establish an account that they can access for the initial application, but also the ongoing needs as they continue to remain licensed in the state, renewal information, things like that. Also talk about the number of this continuing medical education requirements or continuing education units for the various types of licensees. We can basically provide, you know, information as far as statute and regulation that, you know, impacts their practice. We also, you know, provide basically, we have attorneys here in-house, several, and we take questions, phone calls and emails to our general mailbox, respond back to those. So yeah, there's a lot of information there that I think is beneficial to our licensees. And again, if they have questions about the application process, if they're yet to be a licensee, they can reach out to our licensing division. And when they do apply, they're actually assigned a dedicated licensure specialist based on the first couple letters of their last name. So there's someone that can, you know, guide them through the application process. And of course, you know, later on, we're certainly available for various questions. Even questions about the investigation process, as you know, sometimes when our licensees are brought into that, you know, basically milieu, they have questions. And so we receive, you know, questions our investigations division does as well about those kind of things.
Nice. Okay. And then on the flip side, what types of services does the board provide to patients and other consumers?
I think that's one of the most important things I want to talk to you about today is I really strongly encourage people to access our website. Just like I use the example, if you're buying a vehicle, you're probably going to do some research, you know what you want, and you're going to basically try to find out, you know, what's going to be whatever your criteria you're looking for. Are you looking for the, you know, basically most fuel efficient, the you know, best basically cost, the highest rated, things like that. We put effort into things that we consider kind of, you know, big purchases. And I think anytime that you're going to be treated by a medical professional, I think that's, you know, you're making an investment in your well-being. And so I think that people should go on our website. We have basically information for the patient, the consumer that talks about certainly any basic information, discipline information that, you know, might have occurred here in Nevada as it relates to a licensee. We also have information on their education, how long they've been practicing in the state, their stated specialty. And then again, you know, if they want to file a complaint, they're aggrieved by one of our licensees. They have the ability to do that through our website. They can either download a complaint form and send it to the board, or they can actually upload the complaint form on the website and just have it sent to us directly. or basically sometimes basically people have, you know, want information on their licensees. And so we provide lists, things like that to the consumers. But again, I really think the best resource and most important thing is kind of learning what you hope for, expect in your medical professional. And so we try to give as much information as we can. We also post basically information about our board meetings, our agendas, both past and, you know, upcoming. We have basically regulatory efforts that are undertaken regularly. And so those are always noticed. So those kinds of things you can find available, you know, through our website. And so I would just encourage people to take a look at that. I just want to get that in. The website address is MedBoard, that's MedBoard.nv.gov. And so I encourage your listeners to take a look. And if they have other questions, as I said earlier, they can reach out to the various divisions for the clarification. We also have a 1-800 number that's listed on the website that they can call from anywhere in the state or even out of state, of course.
Okay. Now, when you're talking about being able to look up disciplinary action and even file a complaint, what types of complaints do people typically file with the board?
I'd say probably the majority of the complaints we receive are standard of care issues, meaning they feel like that there's been some kind of substandard practice of medicine or, you know, the other specialties, perfusion or respiratory care. And so we have that, of course, information if it exists previously, they can look to. I think the reality is the vast majority of our licensees do not have any, and I'm obviously pleased about that. But we certainly want to make sure that their information is accessible and if there's anything that would be of, you know, concern or interest. And it's not always just patients or consumers. It's also potential future employers, the like. So I think we have a lot of other areas that are kind of a focus. You know, prescribing matters for a while were pretty big last few years. We consistently see complaints potentially come in about demeanor or interactions with patients. But as I said, the vast majority are still kind of standard of care. And that's where we have a process that, again, is explained simply on the website. But that's generally, I think, you know, what we see on a regular basis.
Okay. What is the Nevada State Board of Medical Examiners' new digital fingerprinting process?
So this basically kicked in late March, early April. And just so the listeners are aware, state law, you know, does require that all board applicants are fingerprinted, and those fingerprints are themselves and the results provided to the board as part of the application process. And certainly that goes back to public safety and all. And so the past practice, though, was basically a requirement that we sent all via email or mail hard copies of all authorization forms, fingerprint cards, and the instructions to every applicant. With what we call live scan, the advent of live scan most recently. So applicants are now able to go to various basically entities that have live scan machines, and many of those are private, but certainly every, you know, law enforcement office, sheriff, city police department has these type of machines. And so they can go to those places and actually have their fingerprints done without the need for, you know, the hard card, which was what in the past they'd have to get those fingerprints. That hard card was sent back to the board, and then the board actually had to go through the initial step of forwarding that fingerprint card back to Nevada's Department of Public Safety for their processing. Now, when the folks use the live scan facilities, those results are sent directly to Nevada's Department of Public Safety. So taking that additional step out of having to send the copies back to the board. And so it was more time consuming and just more additional, you know, responsibility or effort required of the applicant. So this does certainly expedite the process, makes it a little more efficient and easy for the applicant. The one caveat I would say, though, is pursuant to Nevada Department of Public Safety's own internal protocols, if an individual is basically getting fingerprinted outside of the state of Nevada, they cannot use live scan facilities. They still have to use the traditional route, which is, again, having it sent by mail to them and then returning that to us. But I think this is a really great thing because I'd say probably at least a third, maybe more, of individuals who are applying for license in the state are already here in the state of Nevada or are able to get to the state of Nevada to go to these facilities and have their fingerprints taken.
Yeah, that's awesome. So the organization serves all areas of Nevada?
We do. Yes, certainly the jurisdiction resides throughout the state. One thing that I think people maybe don't really appreciate, too, is our jurisdiction is not just confined to the state of Nevada. The practice of medicine is considered to occur in any jurisdiction where the patient resides. So the reason I'm pointing this out is because we may have individuals, and we do have individuals who are licensed all over the world. I use the example. So say there's a radiology, some pictures taken, or CT, something along those lines. It's 3 a.m. in Las Vegas. A lot of the people that would be doing those reads are probably, if they practice traditionally, aren't awake or working hours. But, if we look over to Australia where we have dozens of licensees, it's 3 p.m. So I only say that because our jurisdiction is actually almost worldwide. But as long as the practice of medicine takes place in Nevada, then the patient, is residing in Nevada, we maintain jurisdiction. And the other thing too, that's important, we, obviously a very much a tourist destination, Vegas, as well as Reno and Tahoe. And so oftentimes people that come from out of country or out of state, they have medical issues. And if they're treated by a Nevada licensee at the time they're here, then basically just again, so it's not just the Nevada citizens. I want to make sure people understand too. We cater to those who come to the state and are treated by our licensees. So.
Okay. And then, with the prevalence of online medical services these days, I've noticed that often the practitioners serve Nevada, but they're not located in Nevada. So, So you license them as well?
Yes, ma'am. That's basically, we have a couple types of licenses. First off, our unlimited license allows for practice of medicine via telemedicine, either in the state or abroad. And certainly the unrestricted allows for that in-person, consultation or interaction with patients in the state. But yes, we have also another category called a special purpose license, which is specifically designed for telemedicine. And that means basically that you can only practice telemedicine with that license on Nevada patients. You could technically be in Reno and be practicing telemedicine, to a patient in Las Vegas. And that meets that definition, but it couldn't be the in-person. And the other thing too, talking about the increase, significant increase, quite frankly, since COVID, of telemedicine and telemedicine licenses that are being issued. We issued about 2,100 licenses last year in total for all our specialties. Of those, about 1,700 were medical doctors. And of those, over 50% were actually licenses that were obtained through basically something we have in the state and most jurisdictions do now, called the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. And the vast, vast, vast majority of people that are getting licensed through the compact are doing telemedicine. So yes, it certainly has become much more common. I think we all recognize there's some things you can't do through a phone or a TV camera on your computer, but there's still a lot of things that can be. And what's important, what's really kind of brought this to the forefront, and I think will stay, is the reimbursement requirements for various, federal and even private insurers were basically put on par with in-person visits during COVID in order to keep that continuity of care. And obviously, the desire to not necessarily be in the same, basically immediate area as the patient. So I think, like I said earlier, that's why the COVID kind of stimulated this, even though it was becoming more and more common even prior to COVID. But now I think we're at a place where I don't think it will go back even close to what it was prior as far as how medical care is rendered.
So you did give the website, but let's tell it again where people can go if they want more information about the Nevada State Board of Medical Examiners, first of all, or if they'd like to look up their medical providers or even file a complaint.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, again, that's MedBoard, MedBoard dot NV like Nevada dot GOV like gov. And I think it's very intuitive and hopefully pretty easy to navigate, but there's a wealth of information there. We also put on our website our quarterly newsletters for not just our licensees, but the public. And sometimes there's some interesting articles, things like that. But there's a lot of things. There's also even shortcuts to other regulatory bodies in the state that might have some kind of nexus to our patient populace. And so, yeah, just encourage them to take a look. And again, questions, please reach out to the board directly.
Okay, awesome. So once again, medboard.nv.gov is the website. That's the Nevada State Board of Medical Examiners, medboard.nv.gov. You can look up your medical provider. You can check their license. You can look for any disciplinary action, or if you need to file a complaint, all of that can be done there. Plenty of information. And also for licensees and applicants, same website, medboard.nv.gov. And we've been speaking today with Edward Cousineau. He's the executive director of the Nevada State Board of Medical Examiners. And Edward, I want to thank you for being here and letting us know about this resource that a lot of people probably aren't aware of. And it's obviously crucial. It runs our entire medical system here in the state. So thank you for being here and sharing with us today.
Well, thank you very much for the invite, Heather.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Michelle Rapkin, three-time cancer survivor, 30-year publishing industry professional, and author of the new book, Cancer Sucks, But You'll Get Through It, A Guide from Detection to Remission to Getting On with Your Life. Michelle, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So what inspired you to write this book, Cancer Sucks, But You'll Get Through It?
You know, all three times when I was diagnosed and then re-diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, I didn't have any information except the information that I had gleaned myself about how to find an oncologist, what questions to ask, what should I know about dealing with being bald. And it occurred to me that I know about books. I should write it. So I did.
Someone has to. Why not, right?
Why not?
Now, how did that feel after beating cancer the first time to have it return again and then again?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I went into remission the first time, I thought I was really cured because it didn't come back for 16 years. The first time I sort of got through it somehow, you know, second time, I just thought this really can't be. And then the third time was the scariest, believe it or not. And at one point, it seemed like all of the possible treatments had already failed. And so I was in a very different mental place and trying to wrap my head around and get ready for meeting my maker. And then I was given two treatments that did work against all odds. And how did it feel? I used to think, why me? And then one day it occurred to me, well, why not me? Like, look at all of the things that people deal with in this world. So I tried to remember that and just move ahead.
Yeah, definitely. So speaking of that, what are the most important things for cancer patients to keep in mind if they want to get through it and be as strong as possible in the end?
Yeah, I love that question because it points to one of what I think is the most important things that I learned and is in the book, which is, you know, you feel so powerless when you are diagnosed. Suddenly your body has betrayed you. Your time isn't your own anymore. You're at appointments, you're in the hospital, and you can't even choose what to wear most of the time. You're in some kind of a gown. And one day it realized to me, even though I felt so powerless, I had just been named CEO of a major health concern, which was mine. And I needed to be a good CEO. I needed to be in charge of this health concern because I had the most to gain or the most to lose. And that meant learning things and doing some research and hiring a really good team and knowing enough to let them do what they needed to do, but also knowing enough to ask questions and feel like I understood why we were doing whatever it was we were doing. And that sense of participation in your own healing journey and power, not in an abusive way, but in the most constructive way there is, I have to tell you, that was just huge. At one point, I believe it may have saved my life, believe it or not, because I had to make a very tough decision and was being pressured not to, and did. And if I had made the wrong decision that I was being pressured to make, I might not have been able to have chemo and my cancer might have taken over. So that to me is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. So keeping that in mind that cancer patients have more power than they might think, what's the first thing they should do when diagnosed with cancer?
Well, you know, there's a whole section I have of things that addresses that. One thing, believe it or not, is you should make a dentist appointment right away because once you start to get treated for cancer, you probably can't risk having bleeding. And so you're not going to be able to go to the dentist for 6 months at least because you can't afford to get prodded that way. So go to the dentist. If you're really nervous before chemo or before a treatment, don't hesitate to ask your doctor for a sedative before they start. that can make all the difference. Don't use anybody else's cell phone because cell phones are germ factories. Drink a lot of water because that really, I won't even go into all of the great things that does. You know, once you meet your team, become good friends with your oncology nurse because she's the one who you're going to spend the most time with when you're getting treatments. That's just a few things.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. That's some great advice that most people wouldn't necessarily think of right off the top.
Yeah.
So now a lot of the times the focus is on the physical body and the physical healing, but how can a cancer patient take care of the full holistic mind, body, and spirit?
Yeah, that's really big. For one thing, be your own best friend. And what I mean by that is if you are someone who is hard on yourself, which I definitely am, cut yourself a lot of slack. If you don't feel like having company and somebody comes, you can greet them at the door and say, you know what? I just don't feel great today. I'm so glad you came, but why don't you call me soon and we'll set up a time. Again, that goes with the power, but it also it just is a very practical way of taking care of yourself. If you feel like you're getting depressed, which definitely happens to a lot of people who are in this kind of a journey, don't be afraid to get some help. Whatever cancer treatment you're getting, there's a nurse navigator. It's a role within hospitals and cancer departments, and they will help you find a therapist to talk to. Also, journaling is, there's something about writing that is a healing experience and provides insights and comfort from within ourselves. My faith is an important part of me, and I prayed a lot. And you know what? I started out just praying for myself and my doctors, but it occurred to me slowly that once I started praying for other people, I wasn't thinking about me and my cancer, and that made a big difference. So those are some things that you can do.
Yeah, okay. And how important is humor in the healing journey?
Oh my gosh, I don't know what I would, in my life, I don't know what I would do without humor. And definitely in cancer, there's a great quote that I have in the book by Reba McEntire that says, to succeed in life, you need three things, a wishbone, a backbone, and a funny bone. And I think that's really true. So while there's nothing funny about cancer, there's a lot of great stuff about humor and laughter. So I include some jokes that only a patient could love, which I won't go into because they're too long. Even sort of dark humor, I used to be a smoker. Fortunately, smoking doesn't cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I've stopped smoking. But one day I was feeling sick with chemo and thought, I just want a cigarette. And I thought, okay, I can't and I won't have one. But this would be a really good time to because I've got chemo coursing through my body. So it would just kill all those cells. And it made me smile. So humor's big.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, now the title of the book, Cancer Sucks, But You'll Get Through It. It's very motivational, but, you know, unfortunately, some people don't get through it. So what advice do you have for people who are terminal?
Here's one piece of very practical advice, and that is, you know, make sure you've got your affairs in order. Make sure that you talk to the people that you love and don't push people away. Touch and connection lasts to the very last moment of our life. And that's important. And if you are someone who wonders about God, think about it. Say a little prayer. It can't hurt. Cancer is a terrible, terrible disease. And not everybody does survive. And, you know, a cancer will probably take me, the cancer I have. The defining feature of it is that it just always comes back. But, you know, we've often heard live every day as if it's your last. And when I thought I was dying, I realized I could spend what time I had dying or I could spend what time I had living. And it wasn't going to change the final moment. So maybe that's the best advice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great mindset. So where can people go if they want to get more information or even pick up a copy of your book, whether for themselves or for a loved one who's going through the cancer journey? And the book is called Cancer Sucks, But You'll Get Through It, A Guide from Detection to Remission to Getting On with Your Life.
It's on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com. Brick and mortar stores may have it. If they don't, they can order it for you. And I have a Facebook page that I devote to issues about cancer. And it's just Michelle Rapkin on Facebook.
Okay, awesome. So once again, the book is called Cancer Sucks, But You'll Get Through It, A Guide from Detection to Remission to Getting On with Your Life. And it's just packed full of firsthand advice that Michelle has experienced as a three-time cancer survivor. So you can find the book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, brick and mortar stores, online stores, and you can check out Michelle's Facebook page for more information. It's Michelle Rapkin, R-A-P-K-I-N, Michelle Rapkin on Facebook. And of course, we've been speaking with Michelle Rapkin today, the author of the new book, Cancer Sucks, But You'll Get Through It. And Michelle, I want to thank you so much, first of all, for writing the book for people who now have that resource that you didn't have, and also for being here today, sharing your journey and sharing some tips and some great mindset advice for people who are going through the same thing. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather.
Hey, life doesn't stop when cancer starts. Some don't make it to treatment simply because they don't have a ride. You can change that. Volunteer to drive with the American Cancer Society Road to Recovery Program. Visit cancer.org/drive to learn more.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Gary Cox, world-renowned strategist, transformation expert, and author of several books, including the best-selling Don't Let Others Rent Space in Your Head. He's helped thousands of people break through their self-imposed limitations, and through his four-step process, he's recognized for doing in one session what therapists or business coaches often can't accomplish in a whole year. Gary, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me with you. This is going to be fun.
So tell us, what is your personal journey with trauma and overcoming limitations?
Oh boy, I unfortunately have a lot of that. When I was younger, I was pretty successful, Heather, as a teenager, and I was doing like over $100,000 a year in business, so that was pretty cool. And then I got married, had a baby, and that's when things changed dramatically. She shortly after that tells me that my baby really isn't mine. Then my father was murdered, grandfather and stepfather died of cancer, uncle killed in a plane crash. All that by the time I was 21, Heather, and then I was unfortunately born and raised in a cult, and I left that about 15 years ago. And when you leave that cult, your so-called friends and family are programmed and conditioned to shun you and treat you as if you're dead. So that put me in a huge mental tailspin, not to mention a financial tailspin, which put me $350,000 in debt. And if I have not depressed all your listeners now, I'll do my very best to reverse that.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. So, I mean, a lot of us deal with trauma of some sort, not necessarily as traumatic as the story you just shared, but what exactly is it that generally holds people back from achieving the best they could?
Well, I think what happens is when we go through trauma and problems, you know, especially the severe ones, the problem with that is it sticks in our emotional hard drive. It's kind of like a computer. If you don't clean it out, it gets slower and slower and slower, even though you're, you know, you're typing away and nothing seems to be happening. So I think that becomes the biggest problem. And if we don't know how to clean it out or fix it, unfortunately, it stacks up as we get older and it gets worse and worse. And that's where the problems begin. And then because of not understanding why we behave the way we behave, because a lot of times people don't understand their behaviors, we have a human tendency to justify or, you know, shift the blame on other things or other people, not looking at ourselves as how we can take responsibility by maybe responding a little bit differently. And then that in turn creates some really deep emotional issues and causes lots of conflict in relationships.
Okay, so how exactly do we clean out or fix our metaphorical hard drive?
Well, each person is different individually. I mean, the principles are pretty much the same, but going into detail is going to be depending on the person. For example, you can have 10 people that have been through the exact same problems, but my approach may be 10 different approaches because everybody's belief system, their core values are totally different. One of the things that we have to do is we have to have an acute awareness that we get triggered. Everybody gets triggered. You get triggered for positive things, you get triggered for negative things, right? So one of the things that we have to do is we have to appreciate that the triggering that happens is something that we control, whether we want to admit it or not. So I'll give you a typical example. I was in California, it was years ago, and there's a lady that we were going to go out on a date first time, and I don't think I'd met her other than maybe online or on the phone or something like that. So I show up to her house, knock on the door, she opens up the door, and I'm wearing a white jacket. And the first thing she says, I don't even think she said hello. She says, "You're going to have to take that jacket off." And I look at her, "What? You're going to have to take that jacket off because my ex-husband had one just like that." That's a problem between her and her, not her and me, right?
Right.
But what happens now is we all have little things like that, that if we're not careful, they're bigger and crazier. And we have to understand that, wait a minute, a lot of these problems is not really between me and you, but between me and me. And that takes a level of humility, a level of maturity to be able to appreciate that, wait a minute, it does begin with me. And maybe it's because of something that you did intentionally or unintentionally, usually most of the time in the beginning, it's unintentional. And it rubs me, you know, wrong way because of something that happened to me 5, 10, 20, 30, whatever years ago. That's where the biggest problem is.
Yeah, well, at least she recognized what the trigger was with the white jacket and why the white jacket triggered her, because sometimes we don't know what the trigger is. And here we are off reacting emotionally to something and we don't know why. So then how do we fix it?
True. Yeah, you gotta, well, typically you often have to know the why. Sometimes you don't. And the reason I say that is because when we're triggered, typically it's a negative association that we have to something. For example, when I do a keynote speaking engagement, one of the things they will often have me do is demonstrate this four-step process that you alluded to in the beginning. And to demonstrate that, I might have literally like a 10-foot snake available where I bring somebody from the audience who's deathly phobic of something like that. And what I'll do is I will go through this process. And the important thing is to understand that that person who's phobic, they have created a negative association somewhere, somehow. I do not need to know where it happened or where it began. I just need to know they have a negative association. If I can change that negative association to a positive association without even knowing where it came from, I can win the game with them, which is quite powerful. I don't necessarily need to know how it happened, when it happened. I don't necessarily need to know the whole entire story. If I can help you change the association, we don't need to know that, because I'll work with some people that they have no idea how they created whatever they created that's negative. For example, let's say that you have a two-year-old child. The child cannot really verbalize very, very well, and you're watching TV, maybe National Geographic, before it goes to bed, and in that video, they see a huge snake slithering, you know, in the forest. And then they go to bed and they have a dream about that snake swallowing them. And they wake up screaming, just bloody murder, curdling scream. You wake up freaking out thinking, you know, somebody's kidnapped your kid. And, you know, the kid is not old enough to tell you, "Mom, I just had a dream of that snake I saw on TV swallow me." But now that child is phobic of snakes for the rest of its life and has no idea how.
Okay. So we don't need to know how the watch was made or why the watch broke. We just need to know how to fix it.
In most cases, sometimes it's okay to go a little deeper, but I think some therapists go a little too far sometimes. You don't have to relive a lot of that stuff, but in some cases you may have to.
Okay. So in a nutshell, what are the different steps in your four-step process?
Well, in a nutshell, it's to determine the why factor. Why do we want to change? And a lot of people say they want to change, but they really don't. And an example of that would be, Heather, if I took a group of, say, 1,000 people who were smokers, and I said to those smokers, "How many of you in here, by a show of hands, would like to quit smoking?" In a group of 1,000 smokers, you're probably going to get darn close to 1,000 hands up. So now if I say, okay, I'm going to share with you the processes and the behaviors that you need to work on to change your behavior, how many of those people are really going to change? So let's make up a number. Let's say 2%. So what's that? 20 people, maybe, whatever. Why is it that only 2% changed when everybody in the room said they had a why, they had a reason, you know, their family, their health, the same old stuff you hear all the time. The mm-hmm. difference between those who changed, Heather, and those who didn't is those who changed had a higher value on wanting to make a change, which means the value is a level of importance they place on something. So what that means is even though everybody had a why, those that changed, they had a higher reason or a higher value on their why. One person, they said their reason was because of their family. Another person over here said the exact same thing. This person changed, this person didn't. Why? The person who changed had a higher level of value on their family as opposed to the person that also said family.
Okay. So that's the first step?
That would be the first step. The next step is to identify what I go to as the limited beliefs. What is a person's limited thought process? For every belief we act on, we get a result. So then if we have a limited result in our life, whether it be finances, business, whatever, it will stem from a limited belief. So the next job is to identify what the limited belief is. And sometimes you're not able to identify. So when I work with whether they be millionaire CEOs or somebody that's got some, you know, trauma in the past, I'm going to identify what their limited beliefs are. And a lot of times when I'm brought up on TV shows, before I take on the commitment of, you know, when they have a guest or they have somebody who's going to be a possible guest, Heather, I want to do an assessment with them. And the assessment is where I'm going to figure out with a short interview what their problem is. And once I define what their problem is, I next need to figure out what is the story? What are the things that they're telling themselves that's keeping them locked in? And once I define what those things are, then and only then will I be able to determine, is this person ready to be helped and make a change?
Okay. And what's step three?
Step three, well, now what's interesting, I do have a four-step process, but I don't do them in order. So what's crazy is step one. What I just shared with you is actually step four.
Huh.
So if you were to get a piece of paper and create a quadrant, you know, four quarters, in your top left quarter would be step one. Then on the top right would be step two, bottom left three, bottom right four. So we did one, top left, and we did four, bottom right. So now what we've got to do is we next then figure out what the limited beliefs are, and then we have to convert them to step two. That would be the empowering beliefs. Now, this is a simple part, but it's easier said than done.
Yeah.
The simple part is if somebody says, for example, they can't. So that's the limited belief. If I tell a person to say, you can, they can say they can till the cows come home. But if they still believe they can't, then they can't. So then you've often heard, which is not true, change your story, change your life. That's not true. You have to change your story and then believe the story. So the next step inside of step two is once they've converted the negative belief to an empowering belief, so I can't to I can, the next process now is to be able to figure out how do we get ourselves to believe the new belief. That is where the key and the success is. Once you learn to begin to believe the new belief, that's when the game changes. So what's interesting is if a person tells me that they can't, the limited belief as an example, I'll ask them on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do they believe that they can't? 10 being the highest. Well, typically they're going to say 10, right? So now if I ask them, if they change the I can't to I can in the beginning of the process on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do they really believe they can? Well, if they believe they can't as a 10, the belief that they can is probably going to be a 0. It's going to be totally the opposite. So now all we focus on is instead of the trauma and the problem and the trigger, we now focus on increasing our scale in the belief that we can from a scale of 1 to 10. So we're going to go through certain processes to take them from a 0 to maybe a 2 to a 5. And then all they focus on now is increasing the belief, not the problem. It's a game changer at that point. Then we go to step three, our new emotions and feelings. So as you start changing your belief system, you will create new emotions and new feelings. Then you need to write them down. The reason you need to write them down is because they're so new that the old feelings on step four, the limited beliefs, they're suppressing any new feeling that you have. And what happens is if you don't learn to focus on the new feelings, the negative program that you've had all your life will suppress those feelings all of the time. So you need to be consciously aware of them. That's the four-step process in a nutshell.
Nice. Okay. Now, some people believe that they can achieve the same thing by either doing positive affirmations or sticking post-it notes all around with these uplifting messages. Does that work?
Well, here's my take on positive affirmations. The more you say a positive affirmation, the less you believe it. That's why you keep saying it. I'll repeat that. The more you keep saying a positive affirmation, the less you believe it. That's why you keep saying it. So I'm not opposed to saying or using positive affirmations, but understand the more you say a positive affirmation, the less you believe it. That's why you keep saying it. So ultimately, it's a measuring rod for you. You ever seen these videos on like YouTube where you see somebody going on a roller coaster and they know they're already freaked out, right? So they're going to start saying stuff like, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Well, why are they saying that? Because they don't believe it's going to be okay. And right. The more they say it, it's a measuring rod to let you know you really don't believe it's going to be okay. So with that being said, if you write down the same affirmations all the time, my next question to you would be, how much of that affirmation do you believe? So let's say it's, you know, I'm going to be a millionaire. And I'll ask them, how much of that do you really believe? Let's say they say they believe it. I mean, be really, really honest. It's a four. Okay, it's a four. So now what we have to do is we have to create certain processes or certain things to increase it from a two to a four to a six to a seven to an eight. That should be the focus, because there are things that you tried to believe that you've changed your belief in 10, 15 years ago. You don't even know what they are. You don't wake up every morning saying da 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 da, whatever it is. So I do not write positive affirmations. I've never, that I can recall, written positive affirmations. I've written my goals down. I've gone through, you know, where I'd go every day writing my goals. But when you go to change from a negative belief to a positive belief, so when you say I can't and believe that you can't, and you're going to say now that I can, well, you're going to have to say it over and over. So that's part of the positive affirmation, right? Mm-hmm. So the goal is to convert your positive affirmations into beliefs. Once you've done that, you don't need the positive affirmation.
Okay. Yeah, so it sounds like a really involved process, but you know, you said that you can get results, major results, in a single session. So why does the four-step process help break through these limitations so quickly?
Well, because it gives people step-by-step principles on how to make changes. And I'm not opposed to therapy or anything like that, but I just don't feel comfortable bringing on a client that has a problem and I'm going to spend a year or two with them when I know it can be done in an hour or two. So when I did like 3 years of Dr. Phil's show, The Doctors, and they would bring people to me on their show that most of them had been in the therapy either 1, 2, even 10 or 20 years with things that nobody could help them with. And they've been in therapy every single week. And, you know, my model when I did a lot of therapy wasn't to have somebody, you know, with me every single week for the rest of my life. I want to do things. I want to travel. I don't want to be stuck to a phone or a Zoom every week, right?
Yeah.
So if I give you the tools, though, back to that principle, if I show you how to fish as opposed to giving you a fish, things change. So in my processes, I give people the strategies and the techniques. So now they can see where they're getting off course and they can bring themselves back on course, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so where can people go if they want to learn more about you and your work or learning how to break through their own limitations?
Well, I appreciate you asking, Heather. They can go to my website, and that's garycox.com, and that's GaryCoxe.com.
Okay, awesome. Pretty simple. GaryCox.com, C-O-X-E, is the website to go to, GaryCox.com. There's plenty of information there, videos, and you can see the four-step process in action. You can find out more about what Gary does and why he's a world-renowned strategist and transformation expert. And of course, we've been speaking with Gary Cox. He is also the author of several books, including the best-selling Don't Let Others Rent Space in Your Head. And once again, the website, GaryCox.com. And Gary, I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing this information with us, giving us a taste of the four-step process, why it's so powerful and how it works, and, you know, giving the listeners some tools to start on their own, and maybe they want to continue the journey with you. So I appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for your time, Heather. I do appreciate it.
Looking to make a difference?
Volunteer for your local fire department. Join a family that will serve with you, always have your back, and train you to be the best version of yourself. Visit MakeMeAFirefighter.org.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, June 3rd at 8 p.m. benefiting the Las Vegas Natural History Museum, and Monday, June 17th at 8 p.m. benefiting Youth Leadership Authority. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Golden Ticket Raffle to benefit Junior Achievement of Southern Nevada is back with an updated prize structure, including weekly drawings and a choice of three prize buckets. Tickets are on sale through midnight on June 24th, and the drawing happens at a cocktail reception on June 27th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Virgin Hotel's Manor Room. Check out the prizes, buy raffle tickets, or RSVP for the drawing event at thegoldenticket.org. That's thegoldenticket.org. Angels of Las Vegas is holding their third annual Angels on the Green charity golf tournament honoring National Men's Health Month on Friday, June 28th with an 8 a.m. shotgun start at Angel Park Golf Club, 100 South Rampart. There's also food, raffle prizes, an awards ceremony, and live music entertainment. Find out more or sign up to play at angelsoflv.org. That's angelsoflv.org. And the Las Vegas Clark County Library District is holding their annual Free Summer Challenge Reading and Activities Program through July 31st. This year's theme is all about our planet's beautiful oceans, and they have plenty of activities and prizes up for grabs. Find out more or get started at thelibrarydistrict.org/summer challenge. That's thelibrarydistrict.org/summer challenge.